Welcome to Technology Tangents. We get leaders together to discuss the important tech of today and the implications for tomorrow. Our discussions are fun, lighthearted, and frankly opinionated, but hopefully gives you a sense of what matters, what to pay attention to, and what to ignore. Joining us as always is Jason Goth, our CTO. Hello, Jason.
Hey, Vincent.
And Kevin Erickson is back and ready to go.
Thank you for having me back.
Glad to have
Appreciate
you.
That.
Glad to have you. But even more important, we have a special guest today, Mike Nygaard. Mike's been a professional programmer and an architect for nearly 20 years. During that time, he's been delivering running systems to the U.S. government, the military, banking, finance, agriculture, and retail industries. More often than not, Mike has lived with the systems he's built. This experience in real-world operations has changed his view about software architecture and development forever, and hopefully will change ours today some too. He's also a well-known author and sought-after speaker, co-authored Java Developers Reference, featured in the 97 Things Every Architect Should Know, but probably most known for Release It, Design and Deploy Production-Ready Software. Frequent speaker at QCon, GoTo, and many others. Welcome, Mike. Thank you for joining us today.
Hey, it's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Jason vouched for you, and I think more importantly, vouched for us, frankly. But you two go back a ways, right, Jason?
Yeah, I for those who have read Mike's book, Release It, the first chapter is this story about an exception that grounded an airline. And so I may or may not resemble one of the unnamed architects in that story. But I do always appreciate that there, Mike, there's one line in the book that I've always remembered and really appreciated, which was, Mike wrote, although the architects at the airline did a really good job of architecting this thing, comma, this, had lots of, had this problem. I'm like, I'm really glad that's in there because I have to get a job after this book is published. And so that's been super helpful for me. So but it's good to
another example of you being the cautionary tale.
Yes. Some people's purpose in life is to be a warning to others. And I think that is mine in a lot of times.
Excellent.
Well, I went to a lot of trouble to anonymize that story in the book. So
yes.
You've kind of gone and blown my cover and maybe exposed us both to some risk. But
yes.
But actually, yeah. I mean, the reason that I included that was not just that it actually was a good architecture. It was also that the problem was like buried inside of an Oracle library inside, binaries that they delivered. And so I was really trying to warn people that like tiny, tiny things can have these huge effects on your whole system. And you can never really make sure that you've gotten rid of all of the bugs.
Yeah. It's so true in that case, in that instance, people should go read the book. You think like we get an Oracle driver from Oracle. We don't, we're good, but, there's so many complexities in systems, which I think is actually kind of where we're going to get to today. There's so many complexities in systems. It's hard to even, test all the permutations of things that might happen or even be able to think about the failure modes that might come up. And again, I think that's really where we were going to try to go today. Mike and I were talking a few weeks back and the topic of system reliability and uptime and, production readiness came up, which it seems to always do when we're talking. And he was telling me about some of the things he was doing these days and really focused on radically simplifying, the environments in a lot of ways, and I thought, wow, this would be a really interesting podcast topic because some of those opinions tend to go against what might be considered conventional wisdom, so to speak. So, that's what I really wanted to get Mike on today and talk about.
That's awesome. Yeah. And so just picking up on that topic of reliable systems, it seems to me that in essence, we're going the opposite direction here, right? Like isn't everything becoming more complex in some sense? Now in fairness, we're trying to break down these services and systems, APIs, REST APIs, all of these things in order to sort of simplify, I guess. But actually, it seems to me that like all these modern architectures are, I don't know, they actually seem more complex than they are more simple. And is that really the right direction that we're heading then, Mike? Like help me understand and sort of start to begin to think through this, what seems like some cognitive dissonance that I have here.
Well, I'm now at a stage where I've got some gray in my beard, and so I'm sort of required to be a curmudgeon about a bunch of things and say, we're doing it all wrong.
You're in good company then. I think that's Jason's MO as well.
I will say we have evolved to an architectural style that's optimized for a particular kind of organization and a particular kind of development. So think, you know, back-end heavy with a front-end application and an organization where you have either very high churn or very high growth among the developers. And so you expect that I have low context, low continuity. I don't have a lot of people with sort of global understanding of the system. I want everybody to be able to work locally, independently. And so that's where we get the push toward microservices, that I can do my thing independently of everybody else. My unit of development is my unit of deployment and my unit of operations. But what we've done in decomposing that to make the individual developers or small squads of developers productive is we've changed the granule size of complexity. And so we have pushed enormous complexity into the infrastructure and into the environment. So if you think about Kubernetes-based deployment today, all the pieces that are involved in that just to get a CRUD service up and running with a persistent database, there's just an enormous number of moving parts in order to make a fairly simple API do a fairly simple operation.
You think about Kubernetes and all those pieces, like there's probably also Istio and service registries. And I did this talk one time where I talked about like, well, you want to have a service and then just like layering on all of the things that sit around it, you know, from log collectors and everything else. Like there can be hundreds of pieces, right, to get a simple CRUD service or website up and running in the style that we're talking about, where, you know, you're building something with a lot of the modern tools and frameworks, and it expects all of that to be there. And it in a way reminds me back to the mainframe. It's like, yeah, I can write a simple COBOL program, you know, with a simple front end. But yes, that's because you have the entire mainframe, you know, and all of the service and hundreds of operators behind it running all of that stuff.
Yeah. So the modern example would be I write my 20 line node program that handles an API, and it sits on top of 4.8 million lines of NPM modules that have been downloaded. And I deploy it into an environment where there's about 10,000 lines of YAML to describe the environment. And it configures 400 pieces of software-defined infrastructure to get it up and running. But the piece that I wrote is, you know, just 20 lines long.
Right. And I guess like in some sense, I really like how you broke it down, which is that we've optimized the way that we develop our code, sort of Conway's Law in some sense, to reflect the organizational dynamics going on here. So we assume that developers are going to hop around a lot. And, you know, I grew up in Silicon Valley professionally, and we've all moved around every 18 months. I think that's moved to something more like 6 or 12 months at this point. And so with that, or in sort of more legacy companies where they're just not growing quickly, all makes sense. So are you saying that's the wrong approach then? Like, is it actually inherently better to do something else? Or I guess said differently, what are the trade-offs and the consequences of making the optimization in the code to reflect this organizational dynamic element?
Yeah, I'm glad you phrased it the second way, because I was going to say, you know, I spent enough time as a consultant that I never answer if something's good or bad. It's always, it depends. Right? I would say the consequence of optimizing in that way is operational cost and complexity and sort of the number of different parties in the mix that you may need to get support from. So let's start with the cost. I mean, cloud financial engineering is a growing discipline. I would say it's actually one of the high ROI disciplines you might add to your organization if you're not already doing it. We started doing that at my employer before I arrived. And every week, we found this thing that saves $1 million a year. We found this other thing that saves $1.5 million a year. We found this other thing that saves, you know, $2 million a year. So cloud financial engineering exists because we sort of optimize for developer time and we throw resources at everything to make it run fast enough, reliable enough, close enough to the user. The other place we have problems is when we are in some kind of a failure mode and a recovery situation. When you have pieces of software from so many different suppliers, whether it's open source or commercial, it can be really hard to identify where is the failure originating. And it can be very hard to marshal the people you need to resolve the failure. So, you know, that's just two ways that it manifests. I've also been involved in providing developer platforms, which largely exist to encapsulate that complexity and reduce the cognitive load on the dev teams that results from it.
Yeah, I agree. Those are you know, two great examples, right, of the trade-off, you know, that the cloud cost and the problems with recovering when there is a failure. I would say a third one is security. I think there are so many pieces that have to be configured just right. I think a lot of times, you know, you see the security events today, it's because, well, one of the 100 was configured slightly wrong. And, you know, there's just, to use your NPM example as well, okay, well, I pulled in, built something in Java, and I pulled in hundreds of libraries, one of which was a Log4j library with a vulnerability that I didn't even know about. That's another area where we tend to advise companies to really be careful about security in those type of architectures.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I want to circle back to this developer platform and the trade-offs we're making here. But just to further this, if you look at what Google publishes on their own web page around, you know, DevOps and empowering teams to choose tools specifically, they say if you want to achieve higher software delivery performance, increased job satisfaction of your technical staff, you have to empower them to make choices about tools and technologies to do their work. And this is all sort of foundationally based off the DevOps research and assessment DORA, which shows that better continuous delivery and higher software delivery performance if you do these things. Now, my question here is, on top of sort of optimizing organizational structure and the code structure for this easier to approach, faster to develop my one element, if now they can choose in their own languages and choose their own tools, we're adding in another layer of complexity here. Am I understanding this correctly? And I guess, how do we then begin to rationalize where's the line between everybody develops in one sort of monolithic code base in one language versus everybody does everything any way they want, and then I don't know who's supposed to look across all of that and figure out how it fits together.
Yeah, one of the footnotes that they didn't really publish about the developers choose their own tools is that was just the authors refusing to take a side in Emacs versus VI.
That's always the core question, huh?
And we all know that Emacs is the right answer, so.
More seriously, I also was a believer that polyglot was not only inevitable, but it was beneficial, that it's okay if different teams are using different languages, different frameworks, different tooling. I've changed my beliefs on that over the last 2 to 3 years, in part from my own experiences at my previous employer trying to build a developer platform, and in part from input from a number of people in the DevOps community who have pointed out the impossibility of creating platforms that can actually cover not only all the variations of languages, frameworks, tools, methods, but the combinatorial explosion when you look at all the combinations of choices in each of those things. So if you're going to build, you know, a platform that does fully automated continuous delivery, you really need to have just one way of building things. You can't support every build tool that's out there and have a viable continuous delivery pipeline. It'll simply be too expensive to support all of those different variations. Then add in different languages that you need to scan for defects, different frameworks and libraries that you need to have some way of automating testing, and it gets out of control very quickly. So there is a balance that must be struck. I don't know if the right number is one of everything, you know, one code base, one language, one framework. I do know that the right number is not anything goes.
If there's n number of teams, then the right number is n. That's certainly not the right number.
Well, it'd be actually, yeah, to his point, it'd be like n per decision. So if you choose those three dimensions that you just said, it'd be actually like n cubed at that point alone, right?
Exactly.
Like that, in that, I think that that's what I'm getting at is like, that was sort of the basic question. Like, it feels like, geez, like if we could have different languages for everything, we have different architectural approaches for everything, different platforms for everything. It feels overwhelming just to think about now asking somebody to figure out how these things fit together feels overwhelming.
Yeah, I would love to be able to dig into some of that raw data and some of the Google Dora research because it's a lot of that is survey driven. And so, you know, they do a bunch of analysis to say, these are the practices that when implemented, you know, have a strong correlation to software improvement. But those practices are based on survey where they say, you know, yes, we allow that, but that doesn't mean that they're actually have teams using different patterns. And I know one of the big responders to all of that Dora survey is a financial services firm. I don't think we can say the name, but I do know they have standardized entirely on Go and as a language and entirely on the same set of build tools. And that's probably a very long-winded way of saying is like, I wonder if they answer those questions as yes, we allow people to do that, but they don't actually do it, you know, to be successful.
And so it sounds like the answer from both of you is the answer should not be give engineers zero choice, but also it shouldn't be anything goes, to your point, Mike. If we try and hone in on, you know, some approach in the middle, the other thing that comes to mind to me is if you chose zero, like you must use just Go as an example. I mean, how do they even get to Go would be a question that comes to my mind because they wouldn't have experimented with Go to begin with because they're not open to switching languages. So how do you even do experimentation? How would you even discover a new language and whether it's good or bad or any ideas on that? Like I'm trying to like hone in on like where is sort of the right bound of good answers.
Yeah, I'm going to do this thing where I take one domain that people may not know a lot about and use it as a metaphor for another domain people may not know. In material science and particularly in metallurgy, there's a notion of the grain size of the crystals in the metal. There's also a notion, there's a thing called a dislocation in the crystal structure of the metal. The dislocations are what will cause cracks. And when they move and they cluster, you get a crack in the metal. So you would like the dislocations to not be able to propagate very far, which says you want a small grain size. On the other hand, that makes a metal very malleable. And so you also want a large grain size for strength. So you end up trying to balance brittleness with malleability. So there's a similar thing that goes on with your technology choices. If you try to hold back and defer switching from one language to another language or that ability to experiment, a kind of pressure builds up, a tension as your current stack, you know, becomes less well suited to the evolving environment around it. And then you get some giant rewrite, a cataclysm, where you have to change everything all at once. So you want some ability to evolve piecemeal, but that doesn't mean you have to go to every single team does absolutely everything their own way. I worked with a guy from Google Professional Services, a very smart guy named Andy Milo, and he talked about needful variation versus needless variation. So there are kinds of variation that are useful for exploring different ways of solving problems, exploring product market fit, if you're in that space. But there's also needless variations, like do I use two spaces or four for indenting? There's no value to your teams all having different answers to two spaces or four, or spending their time debating two spaces or four. When you scale that debate up to a large organization size, you know, you start spending entire person days on formatting debates. I actually think one of the great advances with Go was that it came with a formatting tool. There is a canonical way of formatting. You don't fight the formatter. In fact, most IDEs, every time you save the file, it gets reformatted according to the standard. That just takes that whole debate completely off the table. You may not like where the braces go for the standard format, but, you know, kind of suck it up, buttercup. it's going to get put back that way every time you save your file. And if you try to be the one person that's different, you're out of step with everybody else who's using Go at your company. So I'm going to adopt that for all my new technologies. They're going to have a standard formatter right from the beginning.
Yeah, I like that.
So Mike, you know, you were talking about building developer platforms, right, as ways to abstract all of that so that the developers can just focus on it. That also has the permutation problem as well. And so as you say, well, we're going to standardize, we're going to only allow this platform, will have a developer, or this technology will have a developer platform for it. Like, how do you evolve those developers? Is that like, well, we'll experiment and we'll add it to the standard developer platform if we think it's a good thing to use? How do you, maybe you can dig in a little on that.
Well, and just one additional question as you're starting to approach that problem. Like, if we go back to the idea of these sort of long grains versus small grains in a crystal, is the developer platform one of these large grains that sort of holds a bunch of people together without adding unnecessary rigidity? Is that how you're thinking about this space?
It's very tough to give a comprehensive answer on this because, again, it's sort of a trade-off question with some optimal point that's not at either end of any of the spectrums. On the one hand, you need your developer platform to be adopted, and so you need it to not be too alien or too difficult to get into or too much friction to move to it. But on the other hand, and by the way, that implies it should kind of be permissive and allow a lot. But on the other hand, that also increases the cost to the point where it may not actually be valuable because you're spending so much on the developer platform that the returns don't make up for it. So there's got to be some point in the middle. And I think that the way you achieve that point in the middle is by not being too grandiose at the beginning. Start with some relatively basic things that you know you can commit to supporting for a very long time. Build tools are something that don't change all that often. We had a little bit of a flurry of excitement around the time that Bazel came out, but by and large, people release one new build tool every year, but mostly it's still kind of Maven, SBT, CMake, like they're just not evolving that fast. So you make these long-term commitments in relatively limited areas, and you don't try to be everything to everyone all at once. And then you add to it as you find that you can, you know, reduce friction and reduce cognitive load a little bit more each time you go through.
So as the resident non-technologist in this call today,
Kevin asleep over there?
Well, I'm not asleep. I am googling my acronyms to understand what y'all are talking about, but I'm curious on, and this may be a really simplistic question, but what's going through my mind is like, who decides? Like, how do you decide, and who's got that right? You have independent teams, and regardless of the choices of what they exist, I mean, we've given a ton of autonomy. Well, how do we decide in an organization? What does that look like, and who gets to make that? And going back, I'm thinking about all the arguments around the mundane details, Mike, like you just talked about with bracket size and spacing, and can just see you could spend that whole element a lot of time around that. So who gets to decide how that works? How do you evolve? But then it leads me to a second question, which is around why do we exist? And this is one of the things I think it's interesting for me for companies. Like, where do we exist to serve our customers? Do we exist as a technology company to create student technologies, to use creative things? Is that become create a competitive advantage for us? I think I find a lot of my clients at times, their technology teams and product teams are more interested in the technology than they are in actually selling something. And so how do we actually keep people grounded to why we're here? What's the purpose? Versus the fact that we're, you know, hiring really bright, talented engineering, given a lot of autonomy, and they get excited just about the exploration. And so as just how we think about keeping people focused, motivated, and aligned when not all our reasons exist, and help, how does that tie back to competitive advantage?
Kevin, I'm really glad you asked that question because I do find that platform teams in particular are prone to sort of getting excited about the technology. And because their users are other developers, they assume that they know exactly what their users need and what their challenges are and how to be productive. And so one of my approaches is always start from the outside in, start with the customer need. even if it's an internal customer, start with the customer need, find out how they're serving their customers, and work backwards to figure out what can you provide to make it easier, better, cheaper, higher value for them to serve their customers.
And it's funny that you bring that up, the internal customers too. I came across a CIO magazine article. And of course, you know, we're still in the talent wars at this moment in time, at least. We'll see what happens over the following 2023. But at this moment, still talent wars. And this article was literally 8 ways to retain top developer talent. And all 8 were centered around the idea of imagining this developer experience. We've talked about customer-centered design. We've talked about customer experience, CX officers, et cetera. This one's really about developer experience. And, you know, they had some interesting stats from Gartner Research showing that human-centered practices leads to better employee performance, 3 times a day more likely to be considered high-performing in these environments, so on and so forth. My question here is, if we think about it through the lens of developer experience, and I'll actually push it back to you a little bit here, Kevin, which is, does this become now a strategic decision for the company, not only in terms of the technology we're building, but how we build it, how we retain top talent to do that in a differentiated way? Does that fall into this bucket in your mind?
Yes and no. I think that it depends on what we're talent. You know, I'm thinking about in terms of your consulting. You think about consulting or building something in a traditional time and materials environment. Do you make the most money based on your best people that can do things fastest, cheapest, or do you make the most money on someone who's solid but takes time? And I think you actually ultimately make money longer in a time and materials environment when you have steady eddy people but aren't going to do it so spectacularly fast. And so when I think about my initial reactions to the developer experience, I'm not surprised that we're going down that path, right? It's a natural evolution, not only from how we think about experiences from the broader sense, but also just the individualization that we're doing in society for people. You know, my needs are primary, and so therefore, why would we not be able to do that? But I actually think there's an opportunity to actually have both. If we talk about the themes of customizing to certain ways that we do things, customizing the technologies that we use, that could get you to an environment where you could have individuals who are pretty happy playing within that structure and they're how to do that. You could also have a different environment where you want to be more cutting edge, more research driven, more exploratory. And that's where you could have your stars and your all-stars could play. And I think that companies have been doing this from the start of time. We've joked before in this forum around, we've always had hybrid and remote workers. It just had to be good enough to be able to get away with it. And as Mike is in Florida, we know that he can do that. And so I think that that's what we're still seeing. So I would love to see the environment to where you potentially have developers that are solid but not spectacular, and you ask them to work within an environment where some of these things are defined for them. And we'll have to find different ways to make sure that they're being self-actualized and growing them. And then you may have others where you work with stars. But my concern, very specifically, if you continue to allow everyone to do what they want, it's very hard to keep us focused on what we need to get done. And I think that that's a challenge that we're seeing today in organizations, where we're so scared that we're going to lose talent, that instead of trying to, our approach to them is to really give them great flexibility. And I wonder, are there companies that are going to be successful are going to be ones that also will give you great flexibility, but we're also going to give you a structure to play in to be able to successful and succeed?
Yeah. Yeah. I have this phrase I like to use, which is, you hear test-driven development and these other things. There's a phenomenon I like to refer to as resume-driven development. That's like, you know, you see people's resumes and it's like, I have Java and Scala and Lisp and C#, and you know, and you know, 100 things. I'm like, wait a minute, you've only been working for 2 years, right? Like, you've worked on these things on average 2 days a piece, right? You know, people want to get these things on their resume. They think it will get them a new job, but they don't really, to your point, Kevin, master any of them. And I do think that there's somewhat of a perverse incentive for people to just pile on things onto their resume. When does that really, you know, make the best product for a company, to your point, or to Mike's point, is this really like the most reliable, the least cost way to develop it? And, you know, who cares? And so I think that's something we have to watch out for. I do. The question of who decides is a really good one, you know, and I don't know, what are your thoughts on that, Mike?
I'm going to ask you to hold that question in mind. Because I will probably forget by the time I get done responding to one other part. Developer experience is not enhanced by having everybody do whatever they want. That actually makes for a terrible developer experience, because when you're coming into an organization like that and you're handed a laptop, you have no idea how to get the tools you need to get it set up so that you can access source code, to be able to run a build, to do tests. You have no idea what the ticketing system is, because for every team, it's different. When you have some commonality around setups, around tooling, around processes and mechanisms, you can actually make it awesome to get on board with that. So when I joined my new employer, I received a laptop that had an IT ops self-service tool already installed on it. It opened up and had four steps to set up. Nice little GUI. I mean, who writes GUIs for internal tools anymore? But nice GUI. It ran some scripts that got me set up so I could access the company source code. I could access the artifact repository. I could run security scans. I could do tests. There was an optional step to set up tools if I was going to be a mobile developer. And so that was actually a really great developer experience. I'll contrast that with a different company that I went to. I won't name them because I don't like to name and shame. But I was in that company for weeks before I could even figure out how to get Maven configured correctly to pull artifacts down from the artifact repository. Now, that's a very basic piece of setup for anybody who's doing any kind of Java ecosystem work. But I would search on the Confluence Wiki, and there were like 80 pages on how to set up Maven. Almost all of them from organizations that didn't exist anymore. They were years out of date. We had a SharePoint site that had files all over the place on how to set up Maven. All of them were wrong. And so because there was no investment in making the tooling awesome, and because there was this spread all over of the different tools, the developer experience decayed into just, you know, you're on your own, basically.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. But I guess, how do I reconcile that with one of the points we talked about earlier in the pod, which is really like the point, the part of the motivation of getting to this world where every team can kind of do something different, not interact with all the code base, but a much smaller subset of the code base, was for the sake of getting people ramped up faster and easier, because they don't have to understand all of the intricacies of everything going around them, just some small little service that they have control over. And that thing's gotten so tiny that it's quick and easy and fast. At least that's how I interpreted it.
Yeah, and great developer experience goes right along with that. If you're providing a great developer experience, your developers don't need to know the entire company's infrastructure and all of the security mechanisms and all of the policies. It's just built into the tooling. And so they can focus on just the service because they've got a way to get the code. They've got a way to run the code. They've got a way to push their changes and make sure they're secure.
I see. So I think if I just play the back to you, what I think you're saying then is actually the idea that we have to decouple these systems and let every team choose their own thing is a bit of a red herring. We could actually do that in a more monolithic way if we'd focused instead on the developer experience as you're talking about it now. Is that right?
I want to not unnecessarily link the runtime structure of the system you're building, which is where microservices and REST and all of that decomposition comes in, with the methods and the ways you build things. How, you know, like the infrastructure that supports development as a practice. I do view those as separable.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can do a microservices architecture with great developer experience. You can do it with terrible developer experience. You can have great DX around a monolithic architecture. You can have terrible DX around a monolithic architecture.
Got it. Okay. That's helpful. That's a good call out. So then back to the other question, I guess.
Who decides?
Who decides?
Yes. I have seen two models. One that works is one that Google employs, actually. For some of these decisions, there is an executive who has unquestionable technical acumen and is like nobody can disagree with him. His name is Urs. I don't know what happens if or when he ever leaves Google, but if you're anywhere on the technical infrastructure side of the house and Urs makes a decision that it shall be three spaces, not a tab, then that's the decision and people just accept it. So the sort of, you know, supreme dictatorial power model does work. It's a little out of step with modern management theories, I'll call it. You can also have a more democratic process. Democratic is not really the right word, but you know, you can delegate this decision and say, I'm going to pull together a group of engineers and I'm going to say, you all make the decision once and for all on format, and we're going to bake it into automation, and we're never going to have the debate again. Because anything that's not automated or doesn't have a test around it, you're just pushing an argument into the future. So y'all are going to decide, but you're going to decide once. And then you also have to make sure you stack the deck a little bit and you have people in that committee who are actually capable of making a decision and driving to closure and getting things done. But that model also works. What doesn't work is I have a divisional chief architect who decides in one area and another divisional chief architect who decides in another area, and they don't like each other because they're each, you know, jockeying to be the next CTO.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I guess, yeah, I mean, the Google model, I guess the question is, I guess, is the Google model replicable to other organizations, or is that just a fluke of having a phenomenal engineer at the top?
Yeah, I don't know much about Google that's replicable.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, one thing I also think on also having the willingness to have an organization that isn't going to change, as you know, we talked earlier about people leaving every 6 to 18 months, and you think about, well, whereas I think we get in trouble, so they have that group. There's a group of people that came, they make the standards, and then they leave, or someone else comes in who's got a different power dynamic, and they spend more time trying to, you know, change the paint color and the drapes than they are actually trying to fix what they're doing. And I think that that's where other elements of the organization have to step in and say, hey, we're not going to re-debate this. And so can even almost you bring some of that into even the courting process and say, hey, here's the things that we've decided, you know, get on board before you come on. And I know my Pollyanna version is easier said than done, but I think it's important for us to think about that.
I think it's also a place where good leadership plays a role in being able to sort of, even if you don't come from an engineering background, being able to sniff out which are the debates that matter and which are the debates that don't matter.
Yeah, that's good. Well, I want to keep on, I'll go back, Mike, a bit to your examples on two previous employers or current and previous around how long it takes to get up and running, because we feel that way in our consulting environments quite a bit, to where we have to go into different clients and just, you know, it's over time for me, it's become a bit of an early canary in the coal mine, so to speak, to understand what I'm walking into if I can get ourselves, if they're paying us X number of hours an hour, dollars an hour, and I can get up and going, or if it takes me 2 weeks or 3 weeks and they're willing to incur that cost. So I wanted to go back to when we think about having the fact that you can get up and going, you think about it from a training and onboarding perspective, you know, how do we think about that from our really organization and getting people up to speed faster, helping them work through that? You know, where are the positives to having that? Where are there also negatives to having an approach to where, you know, here's what you're given, you know, accept it, go, become part of the collective, and we'll see you in 6 months when you're quitting, or potentially you get a performance review at that point?
Well, you've sort of already spoiled the ending of that story, right? Some number of people will not thrive in that environment, and you will have, you know, spent time and money hiring them and have to repeat the process too soon. So it can go wrong in that manner. The other place it can go wrong is the typical kind of paradox of automation. The more you automate something, the more efficient and accessible and easy to use you make it, but also the more you have to spend when it's time to change it. So you do have to plan on a continuing investment in keeping all of those mechanisms working. It's not a one and done type of thing. So you do have to expect, you know, if you stop investing in your developer experience, it will begin to decay the day after you stop investing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm glad you said that, because that is actually, you know, it's a problem that we see when we go in to clients where the goal is to, you know, help improve that developer, you know, or it could be even be runtime, you know, production environment, and there's not that continued investment, right? And it's something we try to preach and tell customers, like, hey, whatever we're spending on this, you've got to keep spending on it, right, to keep it maintained. It's just like your car. You don't put oil and gas and change the tires, it's going to break down. But it's very common that happens. When it does, it's way more expensive to fix than it would have been to just maintain it along the way.
Exactly.
Well, I'm curious. So we've talked a little about, like, you have to do some exploration about new languages. Assuming you're not Google, you have to have somebody who's evaluating on the right platforms, et cetera. Where do all those brain power, where's all that brain power come from? Like, is that a centralized thing? Is it distributed across all the teams directly? Like, how do you think about where that true R&D sort of thinking takes place?
That is a fantastic question. I will say, outing myself, I was once director of engineering for a group called the Innovation Lab. And from that, I have derived a belief that if an organization has a group called the Innovation Lab, you can be assured there is no innovation happening in that company.
Excellent.
I think what you're getting at, Mike, and I 100% agree, is that real innovation has to happen on real problems.
Exactly. Right?
It can't happen, you know, externally, because you're not, you know, you're not solving anything that anyone's actually experiencing.
Mm-hmm. To ivory tower, if it's centralized, in other words. Mm-hmm. Got it. Is right. there,
and, so, and the implication of that is that innovation can come from anywhere in your organization, and it can be stifled and squashed anywhere in your organization too.
So then I guess that makes it, I can buy that argument. My next question would be then, how do you price it into your normal functions then? You know, if you're going to have your normal, have a roadmap, I got to get through that, but we want to allow time for that exploration to challenge. I mean, is that just something you bake into your team structure, expectations? Is that something that happens nights and weekends? I mean, how do you think about it from there if you're allowing it to be spread across the org like that?
It's a little bit out of step with today's macroeconomic climate, but some companies have had this notion of 20% time. In my experience, 20% time as just do whatever you want and explore whatever you want doesn't tend to yield much in the way of results.
Agree.
But 20% time where you say, either you're leading a project, maybe it's an internal project, maybe it's a market experiment, maybe it's fixing something that's been broken for a long time. Either you're leading one of those projects or you're participating in a project someone else is leading. That does tend to get better results. The general premise is slack. Innovation happens in the white space between Jira cards, between epics, around the sprints.
I always thought 20% time was really something you said in the recruiting process, but we never actually did. And you're welcome to spend all the 20% of the time you want while you're on PTO. So
that's exactly right. That's your 120%. You get the 20% bonus for your project. Jason, do you agree? Disagree?
You know, I agree that it happens in the white space. And, you know, to me, it happens when someone has a particular itch to scratch, right? You know, they like see something, it's something they're working on in the environment that they're working in, and it's just grating on their nerves. They, you know, can't sleep at night because this thing is bugging them. And that's where they, you know, go in and really fix it. You know, how do you allow for that time? I do think, you know, we've had some success in just, you know, for a very simple way to say it, like not filling up the sprints, right? Or, you know, having one sprint every few months that is really light and, you know, gives some people the white space to do that. It does require a little bit of management support, right? And that, you know, well, we could pack more into it, but let's make sure we have that white space. But that to me is where, you know, I've seen like the best results.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. I think, you know, necessity is the mother of all invention, right? That's sort of what you guys are both saying is, hey, the teams that are in it day in, day out are the ones who know what problems need to be solved because they have to deal with them day in, day out. And so it makes sense to leave them there. But it does cause this problem that I think CIOs ultimately have to address with respect to, they have to accept some, that there'll be some loss of quote unquote productivity in order to give those developers time to go make the company more productive ultimately.
Yeah, and I think it's Kevin's point is, you know, it's long term. Let's try to optimize that quote unquote productivity in the long term, not this week.
Yeah, you're playing the infinite game, not the shareholder primacy quarterly game. But that's a whole different conversation that I think is fascinating too. But while we're on the topic of CIOs in general, you know, look, Mike, I think that a lot of our listeners are CIOs. They are no doubt constantly bombarded with advice internally and from consultants like us, effectively saying, hey, you know, you got to move to the modern architectures. You have to empower teams to make their own choices, platforms, tools, languages, et cetera. They have to build their own platforms, you know, do that internally because not invented here syndrome, et cetera. What advice would you have for those CIOs listening, given the context of everything we've said so far today?
If I had to summarize it, I think I would start by saying most things are going to be suboptimal and kind of broken most of the time. And that's a hard thing for engineers to accept and get used to. But no matter how great your newest thing is, you're going to have legacy software. And some of that legacy is going to be worth modernizing. Some of it is not going to be worth modernizing. And so treating it like a portfolio where, you know, I'm in a process of ongoing renewal and refresh of my assets would be my advice. Don't try to do everything all at once. You're never going to be able to afford it. And the longer any of your projects go, the more likely they are to be disrupted or outmoded by changes in the industry or changes in the market. So do point-wise refreshes as quickly as possible and get them done as quickly as possible and just keep doing that.
Anything you'd add to that, Jason?
No, I think that's exactly right.
Well, I'm curious then, Kevin, portfolio theory. Now we're in your wheelhouse here. Like, does that fit with you? Does that make sense? Any other ads you'd have sort of taking that from a slightly more strategic economic standpoint of how to balance that portfolio theory?
Yeah, no, it's really good to think through that. I mean, I think as we've joked about before, I always go back to thinking about what we're trying to do and how that plays out across the ecosystem. And you're balancing everything from going back to what we talked before about the high, what's the business value, what we're trying to do, where does that fit in? How does that play out across our employee base? How does that play out across the risk and trade-offs across our technologies and different approaches? And so I don't think there's a heuristic. I don't know if there's a right way to do that, but I do know that if you're not constantly looking at it and potentially changing, the risk is that you're going to become stagnant or going to be passed by. And so to me, really it goes back to where do you think that is your competitive advantage? I mean, things that we've talked about today. Hey, I have a workforce that's turning over every 6 months. Is that good or bad? So I design a solution that allows for that. Well, what if they didn't go? You know, so what if you actually had a solution where we're very static in our technology? So it's not going to attract someone who wants to change. Well, that's a different strategy. It's viable. And there could be a scenario where you want to do that. You know, how do you play out in terms of what products you have? Maybe they're in different technologies, different approaches. Potentially you've grown through acquisition. You know, so I mean, I think there's a lot of different ways to look at that. You know, and I think there is an element of allowing white space. We talk about Slack and innovation occurring that from a technology perspective. I also think that happens in your business strategy. And also, I think it's an area where we get so busy and so focused on the present that we don't think about that. And so, you know, going back to the CIOs and other people that listen to us, I think it's really being intentional to understand the choices that you're making versus just, you know, being, you know, just kind of going through the motions all day long and you don't even realize where you ended up. So no real wisdom in that answer, but just a reminder that you have to be intentional of what you do. Last question. I've had to listen to y'all talk, and so I want to go back to one more theme around thinking about something that's kind of happening now. And I want to go back to this idea of around low code, no code, and what that means for where we're at today and where we're going. So Jason has lots of opinions on that. And in fact, maybe on this opinion is only the area where he has least amount of opinion than phishing. Mike, I was wondering if you had any thoughts around that and how that plays into what we're going forward.
I do have some thoughts around it. And my response is going to sound a little bit roundabout, but it circles around in the end. And I promise it's relevant. When the ATM was introduced, people thought that it was going to put all bank tellers out of business. There would be no humans running banks anymore. But actually, there are more bank tellers employed today than there were before the ATM, because you can have a branch with fewer tellers in it. And so banks opened a lot more branches. There's a name for this. It's a Jevons paradox. When you reduce the cost of something, the total demand often goes up a lot. There's more storage in use today, even though it's cheaper than ever. There's more compute in use today, even though it's cheaper than ever. So when people look at low code or no code as a way to reduce the cost of those expensive programmers, I think that's looking at it in the wrong light. It's not the skill at typing on a keyboard that you hire programmers for. It's the ability to think about corner cases and weird exceptions and think through things in a very precise way. And you're still going to need that with the low code and no code solutions. What you get from using those is acceleration. You get the ability to maneuver and adapt faster than your competitors. And being inside their decision loops is a pretty good place to be. And so I look at them as ways of saying, let's accelerate. I also look at them and say, there is kind of a hierarchy or a gradient of places where I would apply those. So I would apply those places that are close to users, where I want to change things very frequently, much less so in sort of the foundational layers of my architecture, where I need to keep things stable for a long time. Because another thing about the low-code and no-code solutions is a lot of them are startups, a lot of them are VC-funded, maybe some of them had their money in Silicon Valley Bank. So you have to be prepared to move off of them in a short period of time as well.
Jason, did you pay him for that response? No, I did not.
We didn't even talk about it beforehand when we were talking about this call. So,
well, now I know who you're plagiarizing.
Yes, exactly. Now, you know, my answer to that is always like, there's no such thing as low code or no code. It's just someone else's code that you're buying, right? And but I also agree with the, you know, the comment that you're like, you're not paying people to type. And you know, that I've had lots of people call me after, you know, ChatGPT was released and everybody's doing amazing things with ChatGPT. And they're like, well, is this going to, you know, it's going to get rid of developers, Jason, because all we need is someone that can explain to the ChatGPT in English what we want to do. And then it'll write the code. I'm like, yeah, well, where are you going to find those people? Because no one can explain it in English. I mean, that's largely what programmers do is understand that and explain it in English and then type it in code. So I agree 100% with that.
It's pretty amazing. If I go back to our notes from the talk today, thanks again for joining us, Mike. I mean, it's really fascinating because what I thought we were going was about reliability, and I thought we were going to talk about all the languages and really all of this. We talked about all those things, to be very clear. But actually, all of it kind of went around the central theme that was a bit unexpected for me, which is around developer experience. And really, that incorporates a bunch of stuff like, how do you get developers productive as quickly as possible? How do you let them focus on the corner cases, the edge cases, as opposed to sort of the ticky-tacky of how do I instantiate my environment and actually get coding up and optimizing their time, hands on keyboards, truly developing by removing some of just the noise of, you know, two or four spaces on indentation, et cetera. I thought it was really, really fascinating. Is that, would you characterize it the same way if you were to think back to the summary? Is that what you were thinking when you joined today, Mike? Or did I misinterpret everything you and Jason talked about? Because honestly, some of it was over my head.
I think you've captured some of the salient points and some of the pull quotes for sure. But the underlying subtext, maybe closer to Kevin's wheelhouse, which is, how do you create economic victory for your companies or for your clients? And a lot of that is get the friction out of the way, let people do the things that they need to do for you to make competitive maneuvers. And ultimately, you know, anytime we are slowing down the process of development, we're slowing down a business initiative. You cannot do any business initiative without some software being written or modified. And so everything you do to streamline that is competitiveness.
Incredibly salient. Anything, Jason, can you top that, or are you just gonna copy it again?
No, I'm just gonna tell Sarah to, like, we need to name this one, get the friction out of the development process, when she posts this online. That's a great quote, Mike.
Yeah, I love that. And again, thank you, Mike, for joining. For those of you who would like to learn more, you should go join Mike in an upcoming talk, KraftConf. That's actually me in Budapest, Hungary. Is that right, Mike?
That's right. I'll be talking about lessons learned from creating developer platforms.
Amazing. Go pick up his book too. Those are amazing books. Jason Goth has read it and shoved one in my face to read as well. I'm about 3 pages in, I think. So that's a really good book. I'm looking forward to the rest of that. For those of you who would like to learn more, please visit the Insights page at Codera.com. Thanks for listening. Thank you again for joining us, Mike. I really appreciate it. Jason, Kevin, thank you both for your insightful comments as well. And I hope our listeners will join us again. Thank you all.
Hey, I had fun. Thank you.